Welcome to another episode of COVID Chronicles, a podcast by, for, and about people affiliated with Portland Mennonite Church in Portland, Oregon. I'm your host, Gloria Nussbaum, and my guest is Caroline McCarty. Welcome, Caroline. Did I pronounce your last name correctly?
You did.
I'm so glad to have you with me. I'm not sure how long you've been coming to Portland Mennonite, but I don't know you very well, and we always start at the beginning. So where were you born?
I was born in Raleigh, North Carolina.
And how many siblings do you have, and where do you fit in the family?
I have one younger sister named Emily and some cousins that I grew up with as well.
So was Raleigh your parents' or one of your parents' home areas?
Raleigh is where or near where both of my parents went to college, and they met well after college. My dad was still in the area and my mom had moved back. She was working as a nurse and he was an architect.
And it sounds like you did have family in the area.
Yeah, at this point, my whole family is back in North Carolina. I grew up mostly in South Carolina and we moved when I was little.
What precipitated that move?
My mom had my little sister and then, my mom had me and then immediately started her PhD. In psychology. So I was the baby that she would bring to campus for everybody to like practice psychology assessments on and make observations. I think all of her classmates knew me, but I don't remember many of them very well.
Were you a bit of a guinea pig, do you think?
In a fun way. I think it was fun having a baby around because it was a lot of sort of child development stuff they were learning. So fun having a baby around to make observations on. I teach now and we do a baby day where we have families bring their baby to campus and students make observation. And I always feel like it's come full circle.
So you moved to South Carolina and then stayed there for a while?
Yeah, I grew up on the South Carolina coast mostly. And I was there until I finished high school.
What would you do in the summertime as you were growing up there in that area? What were some of the fun things you did?
Oh gosh, we were beach kids. So we swam all the time. And my grandmother lived near us and then with us. So we hung out with her. And, you know, I think I got interested in science because my parents would sign me up for all these science camps and science workshops. And I could remember taking a biology class where we would go down to the marsh and catch things and then learn about them.
Did you have a favorite thing that you wanted to catch when you were doing that?
If we caught blue crabs, we ate them, which was always great. I don't know. There was a wildlife biologist who had a PBS show. His name was Rudy Mankey, and he would do these shows about the marsh and the sort of local wildlife flora and fauna. And I was his super fan. It was, I think, probably the only show we were allowed to watch when we were very little. But I would watch Rudy Mankey's nature show, and I can remember my parents taking me to a live Rudy Mankey event. I thought I had met a celebrity. I mean, I had, in a much more local sense, and I could trace a lot of my love of nature back to that. They would take us hiking a lot, too. We did a lot of fun outdoor stuff.
Did your family go on vacations where you actually went to other places as you were growing up?
Oh, yeah. We were big road trippers. They would pack us and grandma into the minivan and off we would go. We would go to the National Wildlife Federation Family Nature Summits, which is like a whole family camp. And they're usually at or near national parks. And so we got to check out a bunch of national parks.
Is there any one of those that kind of stands out in your mind that was really special and were they at a distance sometimes? It sounds like maybe you had to really travel.
Oh yes. The Harkins family were cross-country road trippers. I had the middle seat of the van to myself, which was great. I remember us staying at Estes Park, Colorado, and exploring Colorado Rockies and just loving that. I think it was one of the most beautiful places I had ever been. And I remember thinking I would like to live near mountains as an adult, which now I do.
Did you always go to public school, or what was your school life like in those early days?
I went to public school we didn't have much access to public kindergarten at that point, but I went to public school from first grade until the end of ninth grade. And then, funny enough, I started off loving biology and I wound up loving science. I really struggled with science and math in high school. And so my parents put me in a really small private school with some extra tutoring. And I caught up and discovered that I love it still.
During those teenage years, was anything sort of coming to the fore? Well, you said science, but were you involved in extracurricular activities of any kind?
Youth group. Church was a big part of our life growing up. Really active with youth group, active on youth Sundays. That was how I learned how to preach. I was my high school's mascot. I was a panther named Pete. Pete was a 7-foot-tall panther. I wore this giant panther head that made me look super tall. The requirement to be a mascot is you have to be kind of silly and good with children. And I fit the bill. So I got to ride the bus with the basketball team and the cheerleaders, but I was essentially a team of one in my little mascot suit. And even though it was a small school, we pretended no one knew who the mascot was, because I think that's a tradition. So I wasn't supposed to admit it was me. I think everyone knew.
Did you have to, quote unquote, apply for that job? Or how were you picked? Or did you have to say, I'd be interested, here's what I can do?
My school was so small that most kids either played basketball or cheered on the team. And I was extremely clumsy. So I wasn't really cut out for either. I think I would have been better at the basketball than the cheering, but I was really well suited for mascot. So that's how I won that competition.
So did you get to talk as the mascot?
There's a fan in the head of one of those big mascot suits that blocks out a lot of sound, and no one can really hear you very well from the inside. So no, I was a silent mascot. I would jump around and...
So you had to kind of do some acting.
Uh-huh. In a no one can see your face kind of way. Kinetic sort of acting.
Did you ever play an instrument of any kind?
I played the flute, but not very well. If I had it to do over, I would learn the cello. It is my favorite as an adult.
What makes it so special?
I read that it's the instrument that's the most like a human voice. I don't know if that's actually true. But I think maybe the things I love about it are the same things that I love about listening to people sing.
Do you sing?
Not really, no. Not very well. I listen with great enthusiasm, and I'll show up for a hymn sing and try not to sing too loudly.
And hopefully we can do that again one of these days. Tell me about church. What denomination, what church? Help me understand what that was like in your growing up years.
I grew up mostly Presbyterian. My mom had been Congregationalist for a while and wound up she and my little sister attended a Congregationalist church after maybe middle school. And then I went with my dad to the Presbyterian church for the most part. And then when I was a young adult, that church dissolved, which left me kind of looking for a new home in the world. And it took me a long time to find one, but when I did, it was a Mennonite congregation, and I stuck around and never left.
And was that in South Carolina, or where was that Mennonite church?
That was Chapel Hill Mennonite Fellowship back in North Carolina.
What took you back to North Carolina? Was that where you went to college, or what's the story there?
Yeah, so I graduated from high school and I went to work for one of my mom's friends who had started a group home in Romania. So I was a caregiver for a couple of years.
In Romania?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I loved it. I learned Romanian. I loved the kids I was raising. My mom's friend had made a promise to my mom that I would go to college. I just wasn't quite ready at 18, and I was lucky that my parents could see that. So when I said, I think I want to work, my mom put me in touch with her friend. So I stayed for 2 years, and then my mom's friend told me it was time for me to go to college and that I could come back if I wanted to after college, but I needed to go get my degree. So I moved to Asheville, North Carolina, which is in the mountains, mostly because my grandma was there and I wanted to live with her, but my parents told me to live in the dorms and be part of campus life. So I did. But on Sundays, we would go hang out. My friends and I would all go to my grandma's house and we would cook a big meal and sit on her porch and they would play music and we would hang out with my grandma.
Is this the same one with whom you had lived earlier?
No, that grandma was still, I was lucky to grow up really close to both of them. So my grandma in North Carolina was a retired sort of farmer, factory worker, my dad's mom. And then my mom's mom is the one who lived with us in Charleston. So they were both still living at that point.
That's pretty amazing, especially these days, to be able to have that close of a relationship with both grandmothers.
I feel really fortunate. I think they shaped me in a really big way. My farm grandma's name is Mamie Sue, and she is still living in that same house that she grew up in back in North Carolina. She's 96. We think she might be the oldest person in her hometown at this point.
Well, I want to go back and hear a little bit about Romania.
Sure.
Tell me again what you were doing. Was this a paid job? Were you a volunteer?
I was a full-time volunteer, and I was financially supported mostly by my home church and would fundraise. And I think we lived off of maybe there were two of us. One of my high school best friends went with me. I told her about what I was going to go do, and she said, I think I'm going to come with you. And I was really surprised, but then really relieved, because it's much easier to be brave and move halfway across the world to a place where you don't speak the language if you're going with a friend. So she stayed the first year. And I think we would fundraise maybe $400 a month. I don't know. We had a little apartment and we could walk to the group home that we worked at. And we lived near the river in a really lovely old city called Oradea. And I learned Romanian, which is a beautiful language. It's a lot like Italian. And it felt a lot like home.
So how did you learn the language? Did you take special classes or did you just learn it on the job? Or,
you know, I had taken French in high school and I was not good at it. So I had this idea that I was not good at languages. But I think what I wasn't good at was language classes, because with immersion and with the chance to speak day in and day out, I picked it up really quickly. I was also working with kids, right? And learning along with them. So I had lots of little ones to practice with and build vocabulary with. But I had a really supportive coworker who wanted to learn more English, just as I wanted to learn more Romanian. And so when we were on shift together, she would speak English and I would speak Romanian. And we would correct each other, at least a little, to continue to grow. And that worked pretty well.
Tell me about these children. What was the story there?
Romania had a policy in which, so this is prior to 1989, families were expected to have children, and the state created these institutions where families were told you could send your child there and they would have a good life. So if you were not in a position to care for them yourself, culturally, you could send your kids to these group homes. What we know now is that that kind of childhood isn't great developmentally, because kids need families. And I actually think we've learned a lot about child development from the repercussions of this policy. So most of my kids that I was working with had developmental delays and developmental disabilities from spending time in large institutions. And so initially what our foundation did, the foundation that I worked for, was open a small group home for only 10 kids. We'd have three people working with them per shift. And there were only four shifts of us. So 12 women total raising 10 kids. And it was meant to be very family-like. And it was a dramatic improvement over a large institutional setting. Eventually, we realized that even better than that would be family foster care. And that's the model that the organization is using today.
Were these children developmentally disabled before they came? These weren't just quote unquote normal kids who came there. They had some reason to be in a group home?
So most of the kids that I worked with were probably typically developing at birth, but had developmental consequences from spending longer stretches of time, either in the hospital or in like a really large institution where they weren't getting adequate care. And I would say about half of our 10 had developmental disabilities and the other half were typically developing because we got them at birth. But they were all children of families who, for one reason or another, surrendered them to the state.
So their birth families were not involved in their lives at all, or were they, like, could they go out for visits and the family come to visit or any of those kinds of things, or were they just kind of given up?
So none of the children in our care at that time had birth families that were actively involved in their lives because they had already legally given up custody. I do know that several of them had families who cared a great deal about them. So we did have at least a couple of moms who sought us out and made sure that their baby had a place where they would be loved. with the goal that they would be adopted by a family, right? And so we were a safe place to stay and a place where they were very loved for a period of time until they were adopted.
The idea was that at some point, hopefully, these children would be adopted. That was the plan. And would those be adoptions within Romania or international or?
Yeah, a mix. So for kids who were legally freed for adoption, some went to other places within, at that point, Romania was in the process of joining the European Union. So a number of the kids that I helped raise wound up being adopted within the EU, and others were adopted within Romania domestically. And then at least a couple were never legally freed for adoption. And so they were placed with permanent. And this is not dissimilar to the way that this operates in the US. Adoption is the best and preferred option for kids who aren't going to be able to reunify with their families. And the next sort of preferred thing is like permanent foster care, like a, if not legally an adoption, nonetheless a permanent family. And so several of my kids wound up growing up in families who consider them very much their own, with or without the legal status.
And what ages were you working with?
I think when I went to work there, our oldest was maybe 3. So I think he was 5 when I left. And then we had newborns.
So fairly young.
Yeah. And newborns who came into our care tended not to stay long. They tended to be adopted more quickly.
So when you weren't working, there you are in Europe. Did you get to do some traveling there and see some of the rest of the continent? Or
back then you could buy a Eurail pass, which gave you, I think you could visit 4 countries. And so we did that once and traveled to, I think we went to Italy, Hungary, and Austria. I wanted to see Venice, so we did that. But I would fly in and out of Budapest because I lived on the Hungarian border. So that was actually the quickest international flight to get to my city. Budapest is an amazing city. It's beautiful. It's full of old Turkish kind of baths and castles and really neat old churches, and it's a river city. I had a good time in Budapest.
Is there some place that you'd like to go to that you haven't been to yet, either in Europe or elsewhere?
Oh, that's a very COVID timely question. I've had a year to think about all the places I would like to go. I would like to go to Japan. I've just seen a lot of travel photos of Japan over the years and thought it was a beautiful place. I've still never been to Hawaii, which feels much more possible now that I live on the West Coast. And I have a friend who lives, actually my old roommate from Romania lives in Hawaii now.
I haven't been to Hawaii yet either. I've been in so many places, and that's the one of the places that I have not yet been.
It's on my list. I work with a librarian who is from Hawaii and has shared a lot about the things she loves about home.
Well, let's get you back to college. Did you know by the time you got there specifically what you were going to be studying, or was it still a little bit nebulous?
I knew that I would be doing a liberal arts degree and that I had some time to make up my mind about what my major would be. And I also knew that my dad really encouraged me to apply for the honors program, so I did. And that structured a lot of my coursework for me as well. I wound up studying creative writing, which I liked a lot, and environmental studies.
And specifically, which university were you attending?
I was at the University of North Carolina at Asheville, which is the public liberal arts wing of the UNC system.
This was going to be a 4-year straight through kind of deal for you?
Yeah, that is exactly what it was.
And when you did have to pick a major at some point, what did you decide on?
Creative writing. So literature. I have a literature BA from UNCA. I don't think I had a clear plan for what I was going to do with that. I think I already knew that I would go to graduate school, but I wasn't certain for what.
So what happened to biology and all those science things?
It came full circle eventually. I think in college, I really enjoyed environmental studies and kind of the environmental science piece of that. I was interested in ecology and environmental policy, and I think I saw literature and environmental sciences combining in that sort of policy direction, like writing policy. I don't know, I took a creative writing course. There was this required intro to creative writing class that you could take. And I just enjoyed it so much because we tried all of the different kinds of creative writing. And I just kept signing up for creative writing classes. So I don't know that I even planned to major in it. It's just at some point I realized that I had most of the classes done that I needed to declare a major. I liked fiction. I liked poetry.
So what did you do after you graduated from those 4 years?
Well, got laid off repeatedly. The economy was struggling. And so I knew that I needed to make sort of practical choices about graduate school. But I think the really formative thing I did was while I was looking for work, I went to a career fair and the Autism Society of North Carolina was hiring. And I met one of their supervisors and she hired me to work just a couple days a week with a family. I was what was called a community skills instructor. So I would sort of teach life skills to youth and adults with autism and loved it. It was a really fun job, but it was also one that felt really meaningful. We would, you know, go roller skating and get out in the community, but then we'd also work on self-care and social skills. And I really liked all of my clients and I liked their families. And so I started to think more seriously about a graduate degree that would help me do that kind of work, make a living wage, and build some skills to be a better support for the families that I was working with. So I wound up becoming an occupational therapist.
So did you go and get your master's?
Did. And that was going to be my stopping place. So I went to the University of North Carolina, and they have a really great OT program. And I loved grad school and wound up sticking around to do a PhD. So I'm now an OT professor, still with the focus on childhood developmental disability. And families, I would say, has always been kind of the like narrative thread of my life's work.
And during this time in North Carolina, that's where you first encountered Mennonites, you said?
Yes.
And how did that happen?
Well, so it's not the first time I encountered Mennonites. It's the first time I actually went to church with them. So I think the other really important thing about undergrad is that I lived in a girl's dorm right next to a boy's dorm. And one of the guys in that dorm wound up becoming part of my friend circle and we wound up dating. So we got married and that's Josh. I think he was a big part of why I stayed in North Carolina. He also had a really close friend who was Mennonite and is now a Mennonite youth pastor. And so she's sort of our proto-Mennonite, I would say. She's from Lancaster. Her name's Amanda.
And you mentioned preaching. When and how did that get started?
Oh, gosh. I would do youth Sundays growing up in the congregation I grew up within. And it was me and a kid named Nathan Bowers. The two of us would take turns doing the preaching. And we're still friends. I think that was a bonding experience. So I wound up preaching a little bit. When I would come back to the U.S. while I was working in Romania, I would go talk to congregations about our work and share a little about what we're doing. And then with COVID, the congregation that we were part of back in North Carolina, Chapel Hill Mennonite, is small. And so we've all been rotating worship roles. And so I tried my hand at preaching as an adult, and I like it. It's fun.
What do you like about it?
Oh, I think I like the way it forces me to read the texts more closely and look not only for what is good news that God is speaking into my life, but in the life of the congregation, to think about how to contextualize what I'm reading, to look for the good news, not just for me, but for us. Like, how is God speaking to us in this moment?
And somehow you got to Portland, Oregon. What's that story?
I finished my PhD and did a postdoc and realized it was time to go in the job market. So I interviewed with a So the friend that I called our proto-Mennonite, Amanda, was out here for seminary, and we would come and visit her and her husband, Zach, and wound up falling in love with Oregon. So I think I had Oregon on the brain when I was job searching, and I was looking for a program that was committed to our work as healthcare providers for, like, working toward justice in the world. And there was a program out here that seemed like it aligned really well with my values. So I came out to interview and here we are. And while I was interviewing, I came to check out Portland Mennonite. because that was a big part of our decision to move. We were so at home within our congregation back in North Carolina that I knew for sure I wanted to find a similar home. So it felt like we were trying on not only a job, but a community to see if it could be a good fit. And it was. That was 3 years ago, or it'll be 3 years ago this fall. We came out for maybe 4 or 5 days. We came up with some friends who used to live in North Carolina and wanted to check out Portland with us. And several of us wound up moving out this way to kind of get the friend family back together. But we went to check out the coast and walked around Portland. I can remember walking around Sunnyside and down Belmont after church, just kind of getting to know the neighborhood. We live on the west side, which we didn't think to check out. But Portland is a good place for us, I think.
So where are you actually teaching?
I teach at Pacific University, which is in Hillsboro, which is why we live on the west side.
Did you discover that Portland Mennonite was a pretty good fit for you?
I would say so, yeah. It's a very different size in terms of number of people. Otherwise feels a lot like home and very similar. I think that combination of Mennonite identity and commitment to social change. I've enjoyed volunteering under the Burnside Bridge with PMC or getting to know the youth. We felt very welcomed. Almost immediately after we moved out here, I got sick. And Portland Mennonite has also been a huge support for us. None of which we expected, but for which I was profoundly grateful that in this new place where we were almost completely alone, we had a community that stepped in and treated us like family and brought us meals for, I think, several months.
Are you okay now?
Fine now. I had a tumor that had displaced my cerebellum. So I had major brain surgery and relearned how to walk. And it was fairly dramatic, but that was a year and a half ago. So I've had pretty good recovery since.
As we're finishing up, is there anything that you'd like to share that I haven't asked you about?
Oh, gosh. I don't know. I think one of the things I realized in putting together that sermon and reading through the texts before Easter, I was thinking about the ways in which the story of Jesus is not at all what the disciples were expecting. And the way it unfolds is full of surprises, too. And about how much of the story is them sort of standing on a precipice, knowing that they're waiting for something big, but not knowing what. And I think COVID has felt a lot like that in some ways. Like that resonated throughout this Easter. And I think coming out of COVID feels a lot like that, of knowing that things are about to change dramatically, but not how. And I'm grateful to be part of a congregation and a community as we sort of come out of this really tumultuous season. I think the other takeaway for me has been that when you come out of a season like this, it's transformative, right? Everything is a little bit different and you have to sort of, it's not so much a return to the way things were as a call to build something new together. And that's what I'm thinking here as we sort of look toward the end of the pandemic.
Well, Caroline, thank you so much for sharing some of your amazing story with us. I feel like we've gotten to know you better, and that's the whole purpose of this.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you for joining us for this episode of COVID Chronicles. If something you heard raised questions or you discovered a connection, take the opportunity to reach out and continue the conversation. I'm your host, Gloria Nussbaum. Until next time, stay well and keep the faith.